dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence who has, thankfully, brought it to bear for our security for decades is our first guest. He is going to set up a very important conversation we'll be having later in the program with John Hancock about the dangers that we are facing to our nuclear deterrent forces and therefore to our country. Our first guest, though, is Vice Admiral Robert Monroe, United States Navy retired, a man who had distinguished service in the Navy in a variety of capacities and also served as the last director of the Defense Nuclear Agency, an indispensable organization. We're going to talk with him a bit about the trajectory of nuclear weaponry and deterrence to set up our conversation with a man who is in the business of trying to ensure our deterrent is effective today. Admiral Monroe, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Delighted to be here again.
So tell me quickly, if you would, Admiral, as you see it, how have we gotten to our present pass with respect to our nuclear deterrent posture?
This will be a very quick one-minute overview of the nuclear era. There have been three distinctive periods which defined the last three-quarters of a century and where we are now. From 1945 to 1951, of course, we were fighting the Cold War. Our nuclear weapons capability was absolutely superb. Decade after decade, our capability, our science was stronger, our strategy was better, and our strength was just overmatched. Our strength was far greater than that of the Soviet Union. At the end of that period, 1991, we caused the complete collapse of the Soviet Union. We caused communism to be essentially disregarded by the whole rest of the world. And we did it without detonating a single nuclear weapon. The second phase was from 1992 until 2016. That's a quarter of a century. And during that time, we were allowed, the nuclear weapons organizations of the United States were allowed to take no actions, make no programs, carry out no research, and so on. And our nuclear weapons capability declined year after year, decade after decade, right up until 2016. The third period, which is just getting started, 2017 through 2019, we're struggling hard to recover the most important elements of this nuclear weapons capability. And that's essentially where we are today.
Let me ask you, Admiral, there are eight quick points that you would, I think, like to convey to our audience that sort of characterize where we are today and what needs to be done in this third phase if we are to recover from the, well, quarter century of malign neglect is the way I think of it. Walk us through those very quickly, if you would, sir.
The most serious problem, of course, lies in our nuclear weapons arsenal, which is colloquially termed the stockpile. It is composed today of about 1,500 nuclear weapons. I might add that back in the 1960s, it numbered over 30,000 nuclear weapons. So we're down to about 1,500 operational weapons and some reserves. These were designed for a 15 or 20 year life because the Cold War was so urgent that technology was advancing rapidly and the weapons became out of date very quickly. I'll jump right to the next point, which is that these weapons are incredibly over age at this point, way past the end of their design life. All the weapons today that we have were designed in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, and they're way past the end of the design life. The second problem, and by far the greatest, is not the overage weapon, but the fact that we have not been permitted to conduct a single nuclear weapons test, an underground test of any of these weapons for this quarter century of the second period. I could ask you a question. Thinking about your own home, your household, what piece of complex electronic equipment would you trust to operate successfully if it hadn't been touched for 27 years? That's the problem of testing.
I can't imagine anybody in their right mind would say they would rely on such a piece of equipment for sure. Bob, and this is compounded by the fact that now our scientists, the people responsible for the stewardship, as it's called, of the stockpile, have not had the benefit of that kind of experimentation, that kind of, you know, real-world testing of their handiwork, right?
Exactly. You hit it right on the nose. The third point was that these scientists, they're nuclear weapon experts, physicists, chemists, testing experts, engineers, thousands of them located at our three nuclear weapons labs, Los Alamos, Livermore, and Sandia. They have not been permitted to, for example, they haven't witnessed a nuclear weapons test.
Let alone learn from them, whereas every one of our adversaries has. Vice Admiral Bob Monroe, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There is so much more to talk with you about, but we will be developing each of these points in greater detail with John Hopkins right after this. But I want to say thank you to you, sir, for your extraordinary service at the Defense Nuclear Agency and, of course, in the United States Navy for decades. God bless you. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, John Hopkins of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and the co-author of an important new assessment of the need for nuclear testing to maintain our deterrent force, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's my pleasure to say, joined for the first time by Dr. John Hopkins. He is a nuclear physicist by training. He formerly was very deeply involved in the nuclear testing program of the United States, rising through the ranks at Los Alamos National Laboratory to be its associate director for the lab, and oversaw in that capacity the nuclear weapons-related activities of that National Laboratory. He's been a visiting scholar at the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, has served as a member of various boards and panels, including the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel. He is the author, or I should say the co-author, with David Sharp, another denizen of Los Alamos Lab, a fellow there, now retired, of an extraordinarily important article. It's entitled "The Scientific Foundation for Assessing the Nuclear Performance of Weapons in the U.S. Stockpile is Eroding." It appeared in the Issues in Science and Technology, winter 2019 edition. This is a publication of the National Academy of Sciences, and it is a very prestigious journal, to say the least. And this is a very, very provocative and timely and much needed article by two men who know whereof they speak. John Hopkins, thank you very much for joining us for the first time, I believe, on Secure Freedom Radio. It is a pleasure to have you with us and a privilege to have the chance to talk with you about this essay of yours.
Frank, it's my pleasure.
Give us just a little bit of your personal experience with this question of nuclear testing. We want to really drill down, as we began to with Vice Admiral Bob Monroe earlier in the program, on the state of our deterrent. But just again, you know, how much experience have you had with the nuclear testing enterprise, and for which period?
I've been associated with the nuclear weapons program at Los Alamos for about 60 years, and I started my nuclear test experience in 1962 when the U.S. resumed testing after the 1958 to 1961 moratorium that was broken by the Russians in 1961. I participated in about five tests in the Pacific during Operation Dominic.
Those were atmospheric tests.
Atmospheric tests. Off and on, I was an advisor for the physics division to the nuclear test division. And then in 1972, I became a test director in the test division and the division leader of the whole nuclear weapons test division in 1974. I continued with that for quite some time until I became responsible for the nuclear weapons development and then eventually the whole nuclear weapons program at Los Alamos. I participated in about 170 underground tests and about five atmospheric tests. During this time, of course, I worked very, very closely with the design divisions. And the way one designs nuclear weapons is the performance is calculated using the best physics that we have, and then testing those calculations with a nuclear explosion, either underground or in the early days in the atmosphere. The concern today is that the nuclear weapons are being calculated, but there is no test, no comparison with real nuclear data.
Let me ask you about that if I can, because, of course, we're often told by those who favor a permanent cessation of nuclear testing that, well, guys like you who had 170 tests under your belt, and there was a total of over 1,000, as I recall, that we have plenty of data. We don't need any more testing. We just need to use that data to evaluate or make informed calculations about the condition of our current stockpile. How would you respond to that?
I would respond to that by saying, first of all, that the physical state of the weapons that we have in today's stockpile differs from what it was when the nuclear performance was tested. We have precious little data on the materials in nuclear weapons in an aged process, and we have absolutely no data on these weapons aged weapons that we have in stockpile today with regard to the nuclear performance. And failures can come about from a lot of different things. One is aging or making changes in a life extension program that inadvertently reduce the performance of the nuclear weapon. And there are unknown problems that have appeared periodically in our nuclear testing program. Many of the problems that have been discovered with a stockpile have only been discovered with a nuclear test.
Yeah. You know, I want to remind you of a fellow that I'm sure we both know and worked with now, unfortunately. He has, like so many of those involved in the nuclear weapons program over the years, passed on. Dr. Bob Barker, I worked with him in the Pentagon. Bob used to say that we were always surprised by what happened when we tested a nuclear weapon. Sometimes it was a relatively small surprise in terms of some marginal aspect of the performance, and sometimes it was a big surprise, like the things didn't work at all. Was that your experience?
Yes, it is. Doing this for a long time, we found that some of the surprises were really very unpleasant surprises. Usually, the weapons didn't work as we had calculated them to work. Usually, those gave a lower yield, but one classic one was fired in 1954. In the Pacific, it was calculated to have about 7.5 megatons, and it went about 15.
Wow. That's a rather substantial weapon, even if it was at the low end. But at the higher end, it's monstrous. And this brings me to a point that you sort of touched on it. And again, our guest is Dr. John Hopkins, formerly the senior official in the nuclear weapons program at Los Alamos National Laboratory. When you start extending the life of existing nuclear weapons, because basically we're out of the business of producing new ones, this is one of the, I think, intended purposes of the moratorium on testing and the comprehensive test ban of which it was supposed to be a part, you start having to jigger things, make adjustments, put in new technologies or eliminate carcinogenic substances and the like. In your experience, Dr. Hopkins, what are the attendant risks of doing that without conducting a nuclear test, an underground, safe, contained nuclear test, let me emphasize, to ensure that everything that's been put back together actually works the way it was supposed to?
The risks are high, and they just get higher and higher as time goes on. I might add that when the laboratory directors testified before Congress in the 90s about the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, they all said that eventually, often using words like 15 to 20 years, we're going to have to resume testing, or we probably will have to resume testing. And those words have been forgotten. The Los Alamos nuclear designers were interviewed in year 2000 by the New York Times, and they also made the comment in 2000 that within 15 to 20 years, we almost certainly would need to resume testing. Now, that was 19 years ago. I think that as time goes on, we drift farther and farther away from familiar territory, and we're in uncharted waters now.
Right. And part of the reason that we are, I think it's fair to say, is that lab directors, between comments like those, have year upon year certified that they were confident in the effectiveness, and I think it went without saying, or maybe it did get said, the safety, the reliability as well of the nuclear stockpile. Did that strike you as either at least wishful thinking or possibly downright misleading, Dr. Hopkins?
I would guess maybe some degree of complacency, I would say. Certainly no one, I think, in this business would actually have a downright lie. As a matter of fact, the designers, or at least the old-time designers who were here, would feel much more secure if we really were testing nuclear weapons. I think we've gotten into this regime where we know that this would be a political upheaval to resume testing.
But it's politics. It's not technology that is driving us at this point, I think it's fair to say. Dr. John Hopkins is our guest. We're going to continue the conversation we began with Vice Admiral Monroe about the adequacy of our nuclear deterrent and the stakes if we fail to appreciate that the scientific foundation for assessing the performance of our deterrent is eroding. The subject of an important essay by him, David Sharp, and we'll be right back with more on that subject and related ones right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for the second of three installments in a conversation with a preeminent, now retired, nuclear weapons expert. His name is Dr. John Hopkins, a nuclear physicist by training who spent most of his professional life, some 60 years of it, involved in trying to assure that the deterrent capabilities of the United States were up to scratch, were able to protect us from the kinds of enemies who would, if they could, take us down. Dr. Hopkins, let me again thank you for all of that service. I think it probably is the case that you are one of the last of the Mohicans, as is Bob Monroe, people who really have the corporate experience and memory to recall how we maintained our deterrent effectively and what we have been doing for about 25 years now that is taking some substantial risks, something you have warned of in a very important paper in the Issues in Science and Technology Journal of the National Academy of Sciences, Winter 2019 edition. It's titled, "The Scientific Foundation for Assessing the Nuclear Performance of Weapons in the U.S. Stockpile is Eroding." Talk a little bit about this history. You know, I remember when I was in the Pentagon a lifetime ago, there was a lot of pressure coming from particularly Mark Hatfield, who at the time was a senator from Oregon and a very important figure on the Senate Appropriations Committee. He was also a devoted nuclear disarmer. Like most of them, he was quite set on disarming us first on the theory that other people would follow our lead if we did. Doesn't generally work out that way in my experience, but he was pressing, and President Reagan was somewhat tempted to accede to it because he really didn't much like nuclear weapons. You may remember his theory for getting us into a missile defense project he called the Strategic Defense Initiative, in part was animated by his distaste for the idea that we had to threaten to blow other people to smithereens in order to keep them from doing that to our people. But in the end, he chose not to go down this road. But shortly thereafter, Mark Hatfield was able to engineer, really euchre, the George H.W. Bush administration into adopting a nuclear moratorium in exchange for some funding for the now lost to memory, Texas superconducting super collider. And in the end, we wound up getting neither nuclear testing nor that technology. But just recall for us, what was the deal that was made, particularly during the Clinton years, when this so-called comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty was being brooded and the so-called stockpile stewardship program was born?
There was a very soothing talk from the laboratories and the Department of Energy about what we could do, and I'm afraid that we sometimes gave the impression that if you just give us enough money for more computers, we can calculate anything in the world, and we won't need to test.
Well, that was basically what Hazel O'Leary was bribing people into saying, I think, wasn't it? She was the Secretary of Energy at the time.
And the laboratories really said, but apparently without a strong enough voice, that we'll certainly try this for some period of time, but we may well need to go back. We may come back to you and tell you that there's a need to resume nuclear testing in 10 or 20 years, and that was 25 years ago. The situation, I think, is to the extent now that it's worrisome. In maintaining and designing the nuclear weapons, we do calculations to predict their behavior, and then we test them to see how good our predictions are. We are not testing them now, and the weapons are definitely changing. Our critics say, well, goodness, how much can a nuclear weapon change in 25 years? And the answer is quite a lot, and we also don't understand it. And we make changes to the nuclear weapons to ease manufacturability, extend their life.
And reduce some of the health hazards associated with having them around, right?
Yes, some of the almost everything that goes into a nuclear weapon is dangerous in one form or another.
Could I interrupt you just for a second on that point? Because I think this is really an important point of calibration, Dr. Hopkins, and you would be better equipped to deal with it than just about anybody. Is it fair to say that the nuclear weapons that the United States designed in the heyday of the program, that is to say, relatively small and highly powerful weaponry, were among the most complex pieces of equipment man has ever devised, and that therefore the kinds of changes you're talking about can make a very profound difference in how these weapons perform, if they perform at all, simply because the tolerances are so small?
That's a very good point, Frank. These weapons, and this stockpile, by the way, that we're in is not, I think, what we would have wished to have if we were asked to maintain these weapons forever without testing them. These are highly, highly optimized systems using the least amount of nuclear material. They're the smallest in size. They are not forgiving at all. These weapons, because of the fact that they're very sophisticated and optimized for weight and mass and size, are ones where small changes, tiny changes, can have an enormous effect on the performance of the weapon.
Indeed. You know, and one of the things that I think, in addition to making that very important point, these were not designed to be untested, particularly for long periods of time, but it's also fair to say, I think they were not designed to be on the shelf, or more to the point, on weapons platforms for anything like the length of time they've been out there, right?
Right, by the way. And my guess is that our weapons are much more critical in this sense than any of our adversaries' weapons, just because we really tried to optimize them for this. But we did not optimize them for a long, long life. This is where I get very uncomfortable with trying to maintain more decades.
Well, and I think you have every reason to be uncomfortable, and it sounds as though others in the nuclear weapons enterprise, or complex, as it's been called, should be pretty nervous about it, too. And I want to come back in our next segment to talk with you about the reaction to your important essay with David Sharp. But before we do that, just a couple more points on this, the condition of our arsenal. Does your concern extend not just to the performance, the reliability of the weapons, but possibly even to the safety of the weapons?
I'm less concerned about that, frankly. The reliability, I think, is the highest one. One has to consider safety, of course, but don't ever underestimate the ability of a nuclear weapon to figure out how not to work. And they rarely have a problem. I just thought of one of the safety issues that is important, and that is we have techniques to make the weapons even safer from a conventional handling standpoint. And yes, there definitely can be. But doing those operations to make it safer without confirming nuclear test would make me very uncomfortable.
Yeah. So to put it in a slightly different way, but I think very much consistent with what you've just said, Dr. Hopkins, we are carrying as our nuclear deterrent weapons that are long past their design life, that are not optimal for the deterrent mission of today, that were not ever meant to go without testing to ensure their continued reliability and arguably safety, and that aren't as safe as we could make them. I mean, all of these seem to me to be really, arguments for a very different approach, especially in light of what our adversaries have been doing to greatly enhance the number and the capabilities. In some ways, as Admiral Monroe said to us, John, earlier, we may not even understand from a technical point of view what exactly they're doing in terms of advanced nuclear weapons concepts. So all of this basically argues for revisiting the posture that we've gotten ourselves into, fundamentally because we started down the road the nuclear disarmers wanted to take us, namely no testing, and knowing full well that the end point on that was going to be we would be disarmed. And that seems to be what is sort of in prospect here, if only by obsolescence. Your thoughts?
Yes, and I think that one of the most worrisome points is that these are complicated, and the present designers are never face a moment of truth about whether their work actually is satisfactory or not. I think we're lulled into kind of complacency.
Oh, that's a key point. We have to pause for just one more second, and I want to come back to that because complacency can be really deadly in this business. And you've done yeoman service, and I know it took a long time and a lot of hard work to do it, but I commend to all of our listeners this article, The Scientific Foundation for Assessing Nuclear Performance of Weapons in the U.S. Stockpile is Eroding, by Dr. John Hopkins, our guest, and his co-author, David Sharp of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. We'll be right back with more with John Hopkins right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back with Dr. Johns Hopkins for our final segment with him today on an important article that he and David Sharp have written, a warning to our policymakers about the state of the nuclear enterprise, our nuclear deterrent posture, as a result of over 25 years of failing to engage in nuclear testing as a key element of maintaining the reliability and effectiveness and arguably the safety of our nuclear posture. Dr. Hopkins, I had to interrupt you. I apologize to take that short break, but pick up as you were saying.
There are two points I wanted to mention here, and that is that when we were testing, if we had a question about a particular weapon, and by the way, their typical lifetime was, say, 15 to 20 years, if a question arose, we just took one of the weapons out of stockpile, and sometimes it had been deployed in, as a warhead and a missile. We took one at random and fired it in Nevada. So I would say that what we have done now is change our criteria from a decisive demonstration of the performance of a nuclear weapon to presumably confidence that they would work because we can't think of any good reason why they wouldn't work. That's a very, very dangerous assumption to make. Second point I wanted to bring up, and that is, if indeed we do, or when we do, decide to resume testing, we can't just go out to do it today. It's going to take years and lots of dollars. And our test site in Nevada, I don't think it's absolutely certain that we could use Nevada for a number of political, safety, technical reasons.
Wow. That is a huge problem because it isn't obvious where else you would do it if you can't do it at the designated nuclear test site. But I don't disagree with you. Again, I think this has been part of the long-term strategy of those who want to put us out of the nuclear weapons business, that over time, the city of Las Vegas would encroach on the real estate of the nuclear test site, and other activities would take place there that would make it difficult to resume testing.
Wow. When we started testing in Nevada, Las Vegas population was 35,000. It has grown 1.3 million people now, greater Las Vegas, since we stopped testing.
Right. And a lot of them are living closer and closer to the site. One of the things that I also wanted just to get you to respond to is a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Stephen Younger, told me a story once upon a time when he was still in charge of the nuclear test site. And that was that one of his bright young proteges in the nuclear design or testing business, I guess, come to him and expressed some upset about all this business about experimentation because, as he put it, it interfered with his calculations. This goes to the point that if you're relying exclusively on computations and, you know, this gee whiz computer science, that there may be a lot of inconvenient facts that if you were exposed to them through experimentation, specifically through underground testing, would show you made some serious mistakes. So this bit about the inability to begin testing anytime soon, even if we need to, is very worrying. What you've described in this article is grounds, I think, for a urgent course correction in this domain. But what would you recommend be done to give us the experimentation that we need?
I think that one can get a long ways by planning what one would do and how one would do it without making the decision, or before making the decision, that we were going to resume testing. There are practical problems associated. We've lost much of the capability, if not most of the capability, to do this in the 25 years since we stopped testing. The political issues of convincing Las Vegas and the state of Nevada that this is safe or important, that has to do with how large a nuclear test we might do. Some of my colleagues have said that, well, we could get by with quite low-yield nuclear testing. Certainly, low-yield nuclear testing would be better than no nuclear testing, but it does not test the whole function of the nuclear weapons, and one could get into trouble that way. And sooner or later, I think we would definitely want to test at higher yields. Higher yields are harder to cope with in Nevada.
Is there another obvious option?
Well, there are other places where we have tested. We tested three devices on Amchitka Island in the Alaskan Aleutians. In principle, that would be possible to go back to when we fired our last shot there, called Kanakin, at about 5 megatons. The island was essentially given to the Fish and Wildlife Service, so there would certainly be some anguish if we decided to go there. That's probably the easiest. There are other places, but they're very expensive and very inconvenient. But it's not a simple problem. The point is one needs to think ahead.
Indeed. And I think planning is certainly necessary. And I think the point that you've made, it seems as though our adversaries have been using low-yield testing to improve their nuclear forces, the Russians most obviously. But speak, if you would, quickly, Dr. Hopkins, to this bizarre situation we've gotten ourselves into, where under a comprehensive test ban treaty that the United States Senate actually rejected, we have been observing a different standard with respect to no testing than the Russians have. The Russians, as I understand it, have said, listen, as long as you can't detect that we're testing, it's fair game. We've said, we're not going to test at all. Is that right?
Absolutely. We've sort of accepted the worst possible option in this. I know that there's some evidence that the Russians are doing some very low-yield nuclear testing, and I suspect the Chinese are as well. There are ways of reducing the seismic signal of a nuclear test, and one could do some very useful and interesting things, although it's not the whole answer to do that. But of course, we've gone out of our way not to give any indication that one might think, where one might think that we were testing low yields. We're not doing so.
This really brings me to a point which I just would ask you to respond to as a serious professional in this business, and that is, I'm pretty certain that if you ask the average American, would you be comfortable with a program that involved relying on very old technology, as Bob Monroe put it, is there any piece of equipment, a sensitive, important piece of electronic gear, for example, in your home that was decades past its shelf life and hadn't been tested that you would rely upon? I mean, that's kind of where we are, but that I can't imagine Americans would believe that we've allowed this to happen. And this most important aspect of our national security is in the parlous state that it is. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I agree completely with you and with Admiral Monroe. And it seems to me that it is so incongruous because the stakes are so high. We're really right now betting the national security of the United States on really unknown territory where we're drifting in with our nuclear weapons. The calculations are changing. The people who propose we can calculate everything, I would just ask, why are you so sure of that? How do you know when you have a satisfactory predictive capability?
Right, when you can't prove it. That's the crux of the issue. And especially as the kind of people like yourself, John Hopkins, are unfortunately retiring or worse, passing on, so that this expertise that's so critical to our confidence is inevitably diminished. And most especially, let me just close with this because we are hard out of time, and that is, the question isn't so much the level of confidence that we have, important as that is, it's the level of confidence about the effectiveness of our deterrent that our adversaries have. And if they have reason to believe that that is no longer credible, it raises the stakes enormously, as you say, and the dangers concomitantly. John Hopkins, thank you so much for your time today. And we look forward to continuing this conversation with you, sir. We'll do the same with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.